It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, farmers and farming groups spoke at the state capitol today to support farm and water quality bills that passed in the Assembly but are waiting for action in the Senate. We'll learn more coming up. First, the number of confirmed cases in Wisconsin of the respiratory disease COVID-19 is up to 6. One of those people has already recovered and been cleared of the illness. Governor Tony Evers this morning announced a public health emergency in Wisconsin.
This declaration allows us to access state resources to deal with this pandemic head-on, care for those who need help, and also limit the spread of the virus. I want to assure everyone that those affected are receiving the best possible care and that all steps are being taken to stop the spread of this virus.
That comes amid major national responses to the disease outbreak, including a ban on non-American travelers coming to the U.S. from most of Europe and the NBA suspending its season. WPR reporter Shemaine Mills covered today's announcement. Shemaine, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
What, on a practical level, does this public health emergency declaration mean?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean there's a crisis at this moment in Wisconsin, but because this new coronavirus is spreading so rapidly around the world and in the U.S., it quickly could become a problem. This formal declaration of public health emergency really just makes Wisconsin eligible for federal money to fight the disease. And it also puts people in the state on alert to take this seriously and do what they can to help prevent the spread of the disease.
Evers mentioned, I understand, food security and Wisconsin's homeless population. What did he have to say about them?
Well, he said this is going to be, quote, a top priority for him. He mentioned why he didn't want to close schools is because a lot of these students rely on schools for food. And as for the homeless and low income, he said he's going to work with nonprofits to make sure that these people get what they need.
Now, we only have these 6 confirmed cases in Wisconsin. At the national level, we know compared to other countries, we are testing a much lower proportion of the American citizenry than many other countries dealing with this are. Did the subject of testing come up in the announcement today?
Oh, yeah. It took up a substantial amount of the press conference as officials were peppered with questions from reporters wanting to know, why aren't we doing more testing? Are we at capacity yet? When will we do more testing? First, I should make clear that we're now up to 8 cases. I just got the press release. Now we have 2 more in Dane County, and they were in contact with a previously confirmed case. So, I mean, it's spreading in the community for sure. And in regards to testing, Secretary Andrea Palm, who has health services, said she's going to ask federal officials for more money because they need supplies to get more people tested.
In addition to that, Shemaine, what are other steps that the governor and the secretary designee of the health department are talking about for Wisconsin?
Well, a big one was the fact they are advising big events to cancel any large gatherings of 250 people or more. They're saying either you should cancel or people should consider not going. Now, this does not include the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee, which is going to be held this summer. They said, well, we aren't there yet. We'll make that decision when and if we have to. But at this moment, it's still a go.
Shemaine, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
You bet. Thanks, Rob.
That's Shemaine Mills, WPR health reporter, giving us the latest on Governor Evers declaring a public health emergency in Wisconsin over COVID-19. Now, dark money groups have a long history of casting doubt on science. You might think about the tobacco industry as early as the 1950s, telling people that smoking was safe. But in a new book, our next guest shows that pattern has continued well into the current day. He says misleading corporate-funded research has a way of making it into public policy. David Michaels is the former head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration under the Obama administration. He also served as the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary of Environment, Safety and Health under President Bill Clinton. He's the author of the new book, The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, I'm happy to be on your show.
A lot of people will think of the smoking story as not necessarily an example of corporations misleading the public about the science they have, but the example, an exceptional case. You make the case in this book that, no, they actually set a blueprint for a lot of other industries.
That's right. You know, we call it the tobacco playbook because we know so much about it. They did it so successfully for so long. And because of lawsuits, all of their papers are publicly available so we could document what they did. But this same strategy, this playbook, has been used by industries across the board, the automobile industry, pesticide manufacturers, the alcohol industry, the manufacturers of the forever chemical, you know, the Teflon chemicals. And that's what the book is about. It affects what's in your refrigerator, you know, what's in the air you breathe, even what you watch Sunday afternoons and what you drink while you're watching it.
And there's an industry, in a way, that is devoted to protecting products from these kind of concerns, these kind of accusations of health hazards. Can you take us behind the scenes? What is this this industry?
That's right. I call them, and they call themselves, the product defense industry. These are mercenary scientists. They have consulting firms, and if you run a company, and you know it's said that the product you make is polluting the air or the water, you call them up, you give them a contract, and they will produce a report for you saying the evidence just isn't clear. There's no reason to move forward to regulate this chemical or to you can't sue us in court because the evidence isn't there. What these companies do, these product defense firms, is they take the criminal justice model. They say, you know, you're innocent until you're proven guilty, and they work it so every exposure is presumed innocent, and there's always questions. Of course, their business model is to produce exactly the study, the report that their sponsors need. So when I was in the government, I saw this up close over and over again. One of these firms that I knew not to trust would issue a report or a study saying, oh, this chemical, this isn't really very dangerous. And, you know, we know better, but it makes protecting the public very difficult when you have those sort of lies coming at you.
And this is often presented as scientific research, and often real scientists participate. Is this just, different scientists legitimately coming to different conclusions about the same question?
Well, that's what it looks like. And, you know, the best example, of course, is climate change, when, you know, there's a handful of scientists who are paid by, you know, the fossil fuel companies who have been saying for the last 10, 20 years, that there's a lot of uncertainty that what 99.9% of other scientists believe is not true. Of course, it's not just climate change or tobacco. They're using it for every sort of chemical and for, you know, sugar-sweetened beverages. You know, the Coca-Cola and Pepsi hire people to say, you know, the studies that say that sugar-sweetened beverages increase your risk of obesity, you know, they're flawed. That's the model. That's what they do across the board.
I want to dig into one of the cases you talk about in your book, the PFAS chemicals, sometimes called the forever chemicals. It's a big story in Wisconsin, and it in some ways feels like a new story in Wisconsin after the last few years, concerns over pollution from these PFAS chemicals, especially in water. But concerns about this, even within corporations, you write, have been around for decades.
That's right. I mean, DuPont and 3M were using and manufacturing these chemicals to make Teflon, Gore-Tex, Scotchgard, since the 1950s. And they knew, and there were plenty of indications, but they kept them secret, that these chemicals were causing pretty serious health problems among their workers and then in laboratory animals. And then when it started coming out that they were also making people sick, they were polluting the water first around the DuPont factory where they made Teflon, what DuPont did, of course, is hire these same scientists to say, oh, no, exposures that to these chemicals only at hugely, you know, elevated levels can make people sick, even though they knew internally that that wasn't the case. We know so much about these PFAS chemicals because there was a big lawsuit in Ohio and West Virginia that was profiled in this movie Dark Waters, where DuPont and the attorneys on the other side agreed to hire some scientists together, and the scientists would be unimpeded from doing the studies they want to do. And those showed that PFAS chemicals are extremely dangerous at low levels when you're drinking them. And that's now we see the PFAS levels in the water in Wisconsin, Minnesota, where 3M is, Michigan, where Wolverine was using these chemicals, at very high levels compared to, you know, what we know makes people sick. And they're still, though, using these same really mercenary scientists when the government is trying to step in to say, you really have to clean these chemicals up. We've got to make sure the level in water is phenomenally low because we know these can cause serious problems at very low levels. They bring in these scientists and say, no, we shouldn't have to clean up the water here because only at higher levels does this cause any danger, this cause any harm. And that's their job. I mean, these so-called science consulting firms, they would be out of business if they ever gave your report with the truth.
A big turning point in some ways for the tobacco industry story was when internal documents started to come out, internal documents from the tobacco companies themselves, that contradicted the public-facing messages of tobacco companies, revealing that they knew about the hazards and yet were openly deceptive about them. For some of the cases you consider in your book, and there's a bunch, do we have that kind of inside story from companies that had a different outside message?
We do on a bunch of them. And one thing I write about is the baby powder and body powder story. And we've read about it because there have been these big lawsuits now. There was one in St. Louis where women with ovarian cancer sued Johnson & Johnson, claiming that the baby powder that they used was contaminated with asbestos. And the documents in that trial that came out that I was able to get hold of led to the jurors giving a $4 billion punitive damage award against Johnson & Johnson because they saw that the experts hired by Johnson & Johnson, their job was to cause confusion. In fact, there's a quote from one of the experts saying, okay, time for more confusion. They snowed government agencies, so the government agencies would never label baby powder as potentially cancer-causing. So for years and years, women were marketed this product, baby powder. They used it for personal hygiene. They used it for their babies. And now we see that that baby powder can be contaminated with asbestos. And they just covered that up for years.
We're talking to David Michaels, epidemiologist with George Washington University, former head of OSHA. We're talking to him about his new book, The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his work and what he's writing about? Have you seen this happen maybe where you work or as a consumer where there's concerning science about some product and then all of a sudden there's dark money casting doubt on it? Do you have memories of the tobacco industry telling people their products were safe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with David Michaels of George Washington University. We're talking about his new book, The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's hard to tell if information you're getting, especially when it comes to consumer protection or workplace protections, if that information is trustworthy or not reliable? What do you look for when you're trying to tell something is credible? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David, we've talked a little bit about the kinds of scientific examples and the doubt. How about the money behind it? Who is funding these groups? Who pays these product-defending groups?
Well, it's interesting. The specific corporations and trade associations will pay the groups when they want, when they want a study, when they want a report saying everything's safe. But a lot of the political demands saying let's not regulate, let's raise the bar on regulation came from the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry together. And that's an important link that people haven't seen. The same people who were the same companies that were trying to convince us that climate change wasn't real, that there is no accumulation of greenhouse gases, they got together with the tobacco industry and they funded the Tea Party movement. And the idea of get the government off our back and increase our freedom, really the point of that was to make sure the government didn't step in and control greenhouse gas emissions or cigarette smoking.
And you write, at least some of the experts who are experts on smoking and why it was safer than we thought are also experts on climate change and raising doubts about that, as well as some of the other examples you give in your book.
Exactly. And you see the same people and the same companies come up over and over again. Look, it's a lucrative job. You can make a lot of money by doing this. And, you know, if you're willing to churn out bad science for one industry, you could churn them out for other industries as well. So we would see the same scientists show up and, you know, claim that silica doesn't cause silicosis or that black lung is not a problem for coal miners. The other thing I write about, though, and this is really one of the reasons I wrote the book, is some of these same, really the most mercenary of these scientists who I saw when I was in the government trying to influence these agencies, once President Trump took over, offered these same scientists very high-level positions in the current administration. So one fellow, for example, I talk about a guy named Tony Cox, who has worked for many different industries. He's on record saying that the science isn't there to better control ozone and some of the other air pollutants that come out of burning fossil fuel. Well, and we saw him when he tried to tell us that our regulation, OSHA's regulation to protect workers from silica, wasn't necessary. He is now the chair of the EPA's Clean Air Science Advisory Committee, the most important advisory committee helping, or in this case, hindering EPA from protecting Americans from air pollution.
Let's go to our callers now. Russell is with us in Beaver Dam. Russell, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about this Roundup stuff. I think the scientific name is
the glyphosate.
I switched over to this vanilla soy milk about 3 years ago, and I've been doing this milled flaxseed, and I'm wondering if this glyphosate is getting into some of these products.
Russell, thanks for the call. You touch on Roundup briefly, I think, David, in your book.
Yeah, I do. I have half a chapter on Roundup, and what I talk about Roundup as this example of a company, and that used to be owned by Monsanto, that to oppose the World Health Organization, which labeled glyphosate as probably cancer-causing. Monsanto ran this secret campaign where they hired a bunch of these same scientists who worked for tobacco and other who worked for the American Beverage Association to write reports and studies saying the evidence that glyphosate causes cancer is questionable. They didn't actually acknowledge that Monsanto paid for them. In some cases, Monsanto actually ghostwrote the studies, trying to essentially push back on this independent evaluation, saying that this chemical might be causing cancer. Now, what's interesting about the glyphosate example, and also maybe Johnson & Johnson as well, is the corporation behind this and their shareholders are actually paying a big price for that sort of really unethical behavior. You know, the German pharmaceutical company Bayer purchased Monsanto, and Monsanto, they continued to sell glyphosate, but there have been these major, major lawsuits in California of workers who developed lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and juries have all said that they believe that the exposure to glyphosate caused the disease. And when they saw all these documents, exactly how Monsanto ran these campaigns, they gave huge, multi-hundred million, in some cases, billion-dollar punitive damage awards against Monsanto or against Bayer. Now, Bayer is never going to have to pay billion-dollar punitive damage awards, but it's hurting Bayer tremendously. In fact, Bayer, the value of Bayer is now the same as the cost of buying Monsanto. In other words, they've lost billions of dollars in their value, and the shareholders pay for it. So I hope that's a lesson to some of these companies, that by taking the low road, in the long run, it could hurt you more than just acknowledging you've got a problem and saying, how are we going to deal with it?
And let's talk about how to deal with what you're pointing out as a problem here. David, you offer some solutions at the end, and one of the keys, you say, is to get research into more independent hands, to not rely on research as much as we do for companies that actually make the products of concern. What could a funding model look like?
Well, the model would be that the company that makes the product should put money into a kitty for the research to be done, but you need an independent organization, either the government or something that's totally independent from the funders, to choose the scientific agenda, to pay for the research. Because, if if a corporation pays me for research, I'm going to start a lab, I'm going to hire people, and I'm going to be concerned about making sure those people get funded and that I get funded in the future, and that's going to influence how I think about that company and the product. You know, research money is as addictive as nicotine, and we know that from tobacco. And so if you set up a system, and we have systems like this, where the research is totally independent of the funder of the research, we'll get research with integrity and research that we can trust. And that's the most important research in order to protect the public.
How do you get there from where we are now?
Well, it's going to be legislation. I mean, the only way to do it, though I think actually an example that is right in front of us, which needs that badly, is e-cigarettes. You know, we need to know what's going on with vaping. Is it, you know, what's the long-term effect of taking in a product that's a mixture of oil and nicotine and flavors, bring it into your lungs, holding it into your lungs, and expelling it many times a day for 20 or 30 years. To answer that question, well, first, it's important to answer that question, but would you trust the e-cigarette companies to give you the answer? I mean, Juul is owned by Altria, the company that brought us the Marlboro Man. So I actually think it could be done voluntarily by the e-cigarette companies, but for other, you know, chemicals, it's probably going to take some legislation to get there.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to David Michaels, former Obama and Clinton administration official, former head of OSHA, now an epidemiologist at George Washington University. And he was with us today to talk about his newest book, The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception. Coming up after the news, we'll learn more about farm and water quality bills backed by farmers and agricultural groups in the state. There's a package of legislation they're looking at, things that passed in the state assembly and now are waiting for action in what's expected to be maybe just a day of action in the Wisconsin State Senate. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump announced a 30-day travel ban for people coming from most of Europe in light of the spreading coronavirus outbreak. We'll talk to an expert about the ban and what it could mean for U.S. foreign relations. First, Wisconsin-based farmers and agriculture groups spoke at the state capitol today to voice their support for a broad range of bills that would address issues like farming and water quality. These bills have already passed in the state assembly but are waiting on votes from state senators. Our next guest is one of the people who spoke out in support of those bills. Kristen Jersick is a farmer with Brotset Family Farm and a member of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why did you want to come into the Capitol and support these bills before we get into the specific bills themselves?
Well, it was a great way for a bunch of different agricultural groups to get together for the common good of agriculture and water quality in our state. So it's groups that don't always work together real closely, and this time all the groups are working together really close, and we thought the Assembly did a pretty good job with these bills, and we're hoping that the Senate will do the same.
Well, let's start with looking at the ones on water quality. What kind of bills are you looking for? What kind of issues are they targeting?
Yeah, so for water quality, one of the things we're looking for is for more staffing for the State Geological Survey, we feel like that position is really important. We don't really know as much about the water quantity and quality in our state as we should, and we think funding that position would be very helpful.
And what other kind of things are you concerned about? I understand you were a hydrogeologist before going to work on the family farm.
Yeah, so I did work as a hydrogeologist, we're concerned about water quality across the state, and again, we don't know a lot about the water quality in our rural areas. And so having more water testing would definitely be beneficial for the residents to our state. glyphosate.
And there have been calls for restrictions on manure flow from farms, concerns that that might be the cause of water quality problems in some areas. And in some cases, farm groups have been concerned that might lead to regulation that could hurt their operations. As you talk to other farmers and farming groups, is that a tension you hear about?
That is not something that we talked about in today's press conference.
So what other kinds of bills were you there to advocate for outside of water quality?
So I personally was there to advocate for additional conservation staffing for the county conservation departments. They do a lot of boots-on-the-ground work across the state in all our counties with farmers, with best management practices like cover crops, waterways. Some counties are doing grazing. And my favorite bill is Senate Bill 715, and that would fund farmer-led watershed grants, support cover crop pilot programs in the state, and create a full-time grazing education specialist at FedCap.
Yeah, talk some about cover crops, and for people not familiar, why they might be beneficial for protecting soil and water quality.
Yeah, so cover crops are planted between other crops, so corn, wheat, soybeans. So cover crops are there to keep a living root in the ground throughout the entire year. So instead of seeing barren soils where we have a lot of erosion, keeping that ground covered and helping keep that nutrient and sediment on the field instead of in our lakes and streams.
Talking to Kirsten Jersik, farmer at Brotset Family Farm, a member of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. She and other farmers and farming groups went to the Capitol today to speak in favor of some farming and water quality related legislation at the state capitol, waiting for action from the state Senate. Kirsten, can you talk more about conservation and farming? Do you feel like Wisconsin has a strong, I guess, ethic when it comes to farmers wanting to promote conservation?
I think we do. We have a strong ethic wanting to promote conservation. And over the last decade, the funding to help farmers do that has been decreased significantly. So we used to have a program promoting grazing in the state, the Grazing Lands Conservation Initiative. All that funding has been gone for the past 9 years. So it's hard to help new farmers really start really strong conservation farms. We've also lost a lot of funding for our extension agents and other folks in the state who supported grazing. So to me, grass-based dairy and livestock production makes sense for many reasons, and it would be great to restore some of the funding for these great conservation practices.
Can you talk about the benefits of grazing in particular for conservation?
Sure, yeah. Well, for conservation, it holds nutrients in soil. On the soil landscape instead of running off into our waterways. So well-managed pastures are perennial permanent fixtures on the ground. They increase soil health. They increase nutritious feed for livestock, which then increases our human health. Overall, when we have perennial pastures, we really increase the water-holding capacity and storing capacity, storing that water. So in times of drought, we have that water there to utilize, but we also reduce water scouring damage to roads, bridges, and other taxpayer-supported infrastructure when we do have these strong rains. So our perennial pastures increase the organic matter in our soil and really help with runoff issues across our state.
Do you see a hunger from farmers to want to be able to do more grazing like this if they could get a little nudge like the legislation you're looking for?
We do. When farmers start in grazing, it's really a new way of farming to them. And so they need support. They need on-farm technical assistance. And they need educational workshops and pasture walks and avenues to work with other farmers doing this successfully. We have many successful farmers in the state that have been doing this for a long time, and we need to have more.
Now, I know there's some consumer interest in grass-fed beef and I think maybe other livestock. Is this something where you could see Wisconsin getting a leg up in the market if we get more grazing?
Yes, most definitely. So we do have the Wisconsin Grass-Fed Beef Co-op that a lot of our grazers sell to. We have many farmers that direct market their grass-fed beef at farmers markets and online and on their farms and direct to customers. So absolutely, I definitely see that we could be a leader in really promoting more consumers eating really nutritious, delicious grass-fed beef.
You were at the Capitol today making the case for these kind of provisions. Did you sense from senators or their staffers you met with that they were interested too?
Well, the Assembly certainly has been interested because they passed these bills. So I guess that we'll just have to watch the Senate to see what they do. But I do know a lot of farmers are watching, as are a lot of environmentalists. So I guess we just hope that they do.
Kirsten, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kirsten Jurcik is a farmer with Bratset Family Farm and a member of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. She joined us today to talk about support for farm and water quality bills that passed the Assembly and will head to the Senate, who are planning to have some limited action this month. Coming up, the Trump administration is halting travel from most of Europe in an attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus. We'll talk about the move and how effective it could be. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the Dow Jones has experienced a lot of ups and even more downs over the last few weeks as the coronavirus outbreak continues to spread. We'll talk to an economist about what the Dow Jones actually tells us and what the index says about the economy. First, President Trump spoke last night about the novel coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19. In the president's address, he announced a number of policy changes from his administration, including the decision to implement a travel ban on many European countries.
To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days. The new rules will go into effect Friday at midnight. These restrictions will be adjusted subject to conditions on the ground. There will be exemptions for Americans who have undergone appropriate screenings, and these prohibitions will not only apply to the tremendous amount of trade and cargo, but various other things as we get approval.
Afterward, the Department of Homeland Security issued multiple corrections to the statement and to White House tweets. Our next guest joins us to talk about the travel ban and the response to the outbreak so far from the Trump administration. Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia is the Samuel Weiss Faculty Scholar and Clinical Professor of Law at the Penn State Law School. Shobha, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, when the dust settled, there were some clarifications and corrections after this. Can you give us the basics of what now is in effect when it comes to travel from much of Europe to the United States?
Sure. We saw a much broader scope in the words uttered by President Trump last night, in contrast to the content and text of the actual proclamation. The travel ban was issued as a presidential proclamation, as many of his travel bans have come out. And it affects people who are physically present in the Schengen area. And so for purposes of the travel ban, that includes 26 European countries. And those are listed in the proclamation. They include Austria, Belgium, Italy, to name a few. And it covers all immigrants and non-immigrants who are physically present in one of these countries in the 14 days before they try to enter the United States. There are several exemptions. So if you're an American citizen, you're not covered by this proclamation. If you're a green card holder, you're exempt. If you have close family members, like being the spouse of a U.S. citizen, you're also exempt. So I think those exemptions are important to read. And I'll finally say that the effective date is tomorrow at midnight. So that part of his speech was accurate. 11:59 Eastern time is the precise date provided on the proclamation.
And then some European countries are not part of this, internal travel zone, including the United Kingdom, Ireland, and a few others. So people in those countries not affected by this announcement. Do I have that right?
Correct. So not every European country is affected by this new travel ban.
What does this mean then for travelers between the U.S. and Europe? They have to, I guess, put it on hold and wait?
Well, if they want to return to the United States, they might have to rethink their plans if they are otherwise covered by the proclamation. There was quite a bit of confusion yesterday about whether Americans are affected. We now know that they are not envisioned or covered by the travel ban. Further, I'm on a college campus, and so we have students who are traveling for spring break. It's our spring break week. I also have international students and scholars and postdocs who may have traveled to one of these countries during their break and may be studying here in the United States on a student visa or a scholar visa. You know, they may be affected if they can't get on a plane by the effective date and time of this travel ban.
Now, we've talked in the past, Shoba, about previous travel ban efforts by the Trump administration, usually targeting specific countries, concerns about them being mostly Muslim-majority countries. This is a different target. This is a different reason for a travel ban. The legal basis, though, is it the same regardless?
Yeah, that's a great question. The section of the immigration statute that the president is relying on for this travel ban is Section 212F. It's the very same statutory authority he relied upon when he announced the first Muslim ban 7 days after taking office in 2017. And it's the same provision we've seen him use in a variety of immigration policy changes during the first 3 years of his administration. The target audience is different in terms of the region of the world that he's identifying, but I would have similar concerns with the legitimacy of a travel ban. You know, connecting or adding more travel bans may not necessarily be the best solution to preventing the extension of this really global health pandemic. Instead, he's really calling this, and he used the term foreign virus yesterday, and that was, in my view, exclusionary and alienating in the way that many of his other bans have been framed.
Have we seen arguments as to why, say, the United Kingdom would be exempted from this ban, where they do have cases of this COVID-19, including some public officials there, why it makes sense to not include the UK while they're including most of Europe?
We haven't, and I think it's hard to find real logic in why or who is covered and who is not. Let's take the expansion that was recently made to the Muslim ban at the end of January. Nationals or certain nationals from six new countries were added, and it doesn't cover temporary visitors, even though they are far less screened than would-be green card holders who are covered. I think you see a similar disconnect here where, you know, how are Americans in the United States less susceptible to a virus for somebody entering from the Schengen area as a green card holder, as opposed to somebody who is here on some type of other category? You know, if I were the president, I would instead pivot to surrounding myself with medical experts and scientists and having a solution for more testing and more evidence-based communication on finding solutions to what is in fact a global health pandemic. We all know from the CDC and beyond that the virus is here in the United States. A presidential proclamation is not going to keep the virus out of the U.S.
Shoba Sivaprasad-Wadia is with us from Penn State Law School, looking at the announcement from the president last night of a travel ban applying to most European countries for people from or in those countries coming to the United States until further notice, but not including American citizens, as we heard, or green card holders. Shoba, do we have a lot of precedent for this kind of travel ban targeting the transportation of diseases?
Hello?
We still have you. Go ahead, Shoba.
Okay, great. We don't have a lot of precedent for the categorical bans that we've seen throughout this administration, where people are excluded based on no other reason than where they are from. You might say that this is somewhat different in that we are in the middle of a global health pandemic, but there still needs to be a connection, in my view, for a basis for a particular ban and exclusion and why people are being left out. There are so many other things that this president could have talked about last night, and I don't see how a travel ban alone will solve the problem we're in.
Let's talk about the rollout. It sounds like some airlines were surprised. European countries themselves who are on this list were surprised by the designation. Is there a right way and a wrong way to roll out a big, fairly dramatic policy like this?
Sure. That's a great question. I would want, as an American citizen and watching the president last night, to feel reassured at the end of a speech like that. And I think his speech left people feeling less assured about the future and uncertain about their safety and health. I think the misstatements that we saw during the so-called rollout were also problematic. He used the word 30 days more than once in saying how long this proclamation would last. In reading the proclamation, I did not see a 30-day time frame. He used the words that everyone coming from Europe would be banned, and that put American citizens and green card holders in alarm, especially those who had traveled to Europe on a vacation or to see family members. They are not covered. So misstating policy is not a good way to roll out the proclamation. We've also learned that he was not in consultation with others before making this announcement. And that is not usually a way to roll out such a dramatic policy change. We saw this with the first Muslim ban as well. The chaos at the airports, we all remember the individuals who were deployed waiting for people to get off airplanes to help them. And that was another example where a ban was rolled out with very little consultation to people who are working on the ground.
With the previous travel bans, there were a lot of legal challenges. We've talked to you before, mm-hmm. spent a lot of time in courts. Given, though, that this is a part of an emergency reaction, whether people agree mm-hmm. with the intent or not, do you expect to see that kind of legal challenge coming to this particular travel ban?
I think that we're in a harder space to make a legal challenge than with the broader bans, which were upheld ultimately by the U.S. Supreme Court. The language of the statute that President Trump relied upon says that the president may, through a proclamation, suspend the entry of any, in quotes, alien or class of aliens if such entry is detrimental to the interests of the United States. So I think if there were to be a challenge, it would be based on whether there's a real national security justification or if the proclamation runs indefinitely for a too long period than what Congress contemplated when creating the statute.
Shoba, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Shoba Sivaprasad Wadia is a Samuel Weiss faculty scholar and clinical professor of law at the Penn State Law School. She joined us today to talk about President Trump's announcement last night that the U.S. would be implementing a travel ban from most European countries, citizens thereof and other non-Americans affected by that. The goal to stop the spread, or at least slow the spread, of COVID-19 and the virus that causes it, the novel coronavirus. Interested to hear from you if you or someone you know is affected by this particular travel ban, or if your plans to travel within the country or beyond, a cruise maybe, a flight, a conference, have been affected so far by the COVID-19 outbreak. Or if you're watching closely to see if your travel plans are going to be affected. You can reach us a couple ways. Email ideas@WPR.org. Send us a quick tweet. We are at Central Time WPR. Or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A police department in Florida is on the lookout for a fugitive, and we here in Wisconsin might just have the skills to help them out. The Pembroke Pines Police Department shared a wanted poster online. Consulting a map, Pembroke Pines is just a bit north of Miami. The poster reads, "Wanted, unknown cow." Description, female cow, brown with a white head, faster than it looks, talented fence jumper, enjoys pools. The police department and some wranglers they've brought on board have been trying to catch the cow since January. So they've had at least, you know, more than a month. The poster goes on to say that the cow is guilty of moving violations, uttering false checks, and fleeing and eluding police. Well, points to the Floridians for coming up with good cow puns. They're up there with the best of them. Thank you for that. However, maybe they need to go out of state and recruit some Wisconsin experts to help put this cow crime wave to the end. Actually, I don't think the cow's actually committed any real crimes. It's just really good at jumping over fences and getting away from pursuit. Any volunteers? Let us know. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.